This show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the perfect place to buy and sell tickets. What's up, everyone? Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific pre-lottery podcast for you today. Jared Sullinger, the Boston Celtics forward, will talk about the year he had and what he's thinking as he approaches free agency. And Tim Connelly, the general manager of the Denver Nuggets, will talk about his path to get to Denver and what the Nuggets could do with its multiple first-round picks. That's next, the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Just a little primer here. In addition to writing and hosting a radio show, I also spent some time last year as the sideline reporter for the Boston Celtics broadcasts on Comcast Sportsnet. And if you watch any of those broadcasts, you would note there was something of a pregame routine. Before every game, Jared Sullinger, the middle-of-the-pack Celtics forward, would toss his warm-ups on top of my head while I was in the middle of doing stand-up. Now, me being the true pro that I am, I was unaffected by any of this, but Jared decided to keep doing it, and Jared decides to join me here on the show. What's up, Jared?
What's happening?
You know, the first time, I could understand it, but then, you know, you didn't affect me, you know. You didn't bug me whatsoever.
Nah, what happened was all the fans kept telling me to keep doing it after I did it the first time. So I'm a fan type of person, so I had to keep doing it.
It became a very vineable moment because every time you did it, I'd get about 50 tweets on my timeline with, you know, screen grabs of you actually doing it.
It helped you out. It helped you out.
No, no.
It helped your show.
No.
It helped your show.
No, you didn't. You really didn't. You tried to diminish my power, but I would not let you. Because I was such a true pro out there that I just shrugged it all off.
I'm proud of you. Grew up.
Let me ask you about this season, just in general, as a team. Do you guys look at this year as a successful one?
Not really. I don't think so. With the guys we had, we brought in, and on top of that, with the experience we had last year, we were expecting to go a little bit further than what we did. And, you know, I can speak for everybody saying that, you know, it wasn't a successful season to us.
I mean, it had to have been mentally draining just from Jay's injury with like a month or so to go in the season to Kelly getting hurt to Avery getting hurt. I mean, how draining was that for you guys in the locker room to see player after player kind of go down and a season that really started off and was, for most of it, one full of potential just started to decline really rapidly?
Man, I mean, we had Marcus out for an extended amount of time. We had Kelly out for an extended amount of time. That's tough. That's tough. You know, especially from, like, especially the Avery, with Avery, Marcus, and Jay. You know, those are really our defenders on the perimeter. And, you know, losing them, not only the scoring ability of all three of them, but just the defense that they put out there and the presence they have out there, that really hurt us. And, I mean, we grind through it. We had guys that was ready to play, and but at the same time, you know, those injuries in the long run affected us.
It felt like the Avery one was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back there because you guys were coming back after being down big in game one. You came back, you know, 5 or 6 minutes to go. Avery goes down with that hamstring. I felt like that caused you in some ways to lose that game. From there, it just kind of snowballed. Is there any truth to that?
I agree. The way he defended, because he could defend multiple positions. You know, from chasing Korver off the screens to guarding Jeff Teague to even guarding Bazemore and just slowing people down. I mean, that ability right there on the defense end, let alone would it helped us out. And then his scoring ability, his ability to knock down the open shot while Isaiah and E.T. and Smart create for him.
Yeah, and I thought you guys got completely screwed, too, by the whatever the rules are governing the seedings there. I mean, you clip Miami, what, 3 times during the regular season, and all of a sudden you have the same record, and you wind up as the 5 seed while they're sitting pretty as the 3 seed. I still can barely understand why those rules are in place.
You know, what's funny was after we came back big against Miami on the last – well, I think that was the last game of the season – and we realized we was in fifth. We was like, we could have saved our energy for that.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't know we was going to be third, fourth, or fifth. And I mean, but that's the price of, you know, playing throughout the season and playing to the end. And you know, there's a couple games that we let get away early in the season, and even at the end of the season, that we should have gotten. And you know, it was just it was a learning experience to understand that we got to finish every game like it's our last.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about with early in the season too, because there was that with that weak stretch where you guys just didn't play well at all. They were lost to the Nets, the Lakers, and you think about those games, and we say at the time, like, you know, those games might mean something, and sure enough, you know, they do mean something at the very end.
Yeah, those are two games that would have put us in the third seed, and ain't no telling what would happen after that.
You know, I was around this team, obviously, a lot during the year, but, you know, from my perspective, it looked like you guys liked each other. There was good chemistry in that locker room. How was the chemistry in there?
It was a great chemistry. You know, it was a team that, you know, we hung out together off the court. We did things together off the court. If somebody had an event, you know, guys would show up. It wasn't just like, you know, we're friends because we play basketball. We really developed a friendship off the court. I think that's what helped us on the court.
Who's the guy that you liked hanging out with the most and the guy you liked hanging out with the least?
The guy I like hanging out with the most, I mean, I pretty much hang out with everybody. So, you know, there's not really my favorite or my least as far as on the team. So, you know, I hung out with everybody.
I think you'd be the guy people would want to hang out with the least, you know. That's just my opinion.
Nah, not really.
You know, overall for this season, how did you feel it was for you personally?
It was a good season. It was a good season. It was a lot of ups and downs, but it was a good season just because I learned who I was. You know, I could have got down on myself early in the season when I was the fifth big coming off the bench and stopped working. But I kept working, got into the starting lineup, and just became a pro's pro.
Yeah, kind of a roller coaster season, at least at the beginning, because it looked like from week one, and this is just based on the preseason, that David Lee was going to start. There would be some other players in the mix for starting, but you would be coming off the bench. I mean, how did you fight through that in the first month of the preseason?
Oh, man, you know, I really didn't worry about it. One, I was going through preseason with a clear mind, understand that it was preseason, no lineups are set, you know, especially for, you know, with Brad and you know how he goes about his rotations. And I just knew, just stay ready, be ready to play, and regardless of whatever happens. You just gotta play every minute like it's your last.
Yeah, because you were going through a lot in that first weeks of training camp and then the preseason. You're not starting. Everyone is talking about your weight, your conditioning. I mean, how much did that weigh you down mentally in the first month or so?
That's over with. You know, before I used to care about what people think. Now it's just like it goes through one ear, not the other, because I know what I can do.
Well, you clearly care what I think because I was trying to get you traded most of the year.
No, not really. obviously, we know what kind of power you hold because I'm still here.
none whatsoever. One thing I know you note about your season was early in the season, the first few months, I don't know the exact numbers, but you were shooting a lot of threes. In the second half, those three-point attempts went down. Was that something just by design? It happened naturally? What did you attribute that to?
I don't know. I mean, I space behind the three, but, you know, I start stepping into my shot more instead of doing, you know, a sidestep into a three-point shot. And from there on, I kept shooting long too. I mean, you know, with Brad being an analytic guy, you know, he wanted me to shoot the three just because, you know, it's worth more. But I just felt comfortable shooting the long too, and I was making them at a high rate.
Was becoming a 3-point shooting big when you started working with Brad? Was that your idea? Was it something the team kind of came up with?
That was before. That was Doc. I'll never forget. Oh, okay. Jay Larinaga came up to me and was like, hey, man, I asked Doc if does he mind you spacing to the three. And Doc said, you know, that would be more space for KG, Paul, and Rondo to operate. And Doc kind of opened up that door for me to shoot the three.
And did you feel comfortable from the start? I mean, how big an adjustment was it?
No. It was a big-time adjustment, especially with, you know, with Doc. I shot 1-3. I think I shot 1-3 before I got hurt, and I was like, nah, not yet. Can't just jump right into it. And that whole summer I was working on shooting the three and working off the dribble as I was coming back from back surgery.
Yeah, you became, you know, a pretty consistent three-point shooter. I mean, not – I'm sure numbers you'd like to see improve, but, you know, 28-29% for most of your last couple of years. When did it start to feel comfortable for you? When did you start to feel like you could do this on a regular basis?
I think it was this year. this year it felt real comfortable because I instead of just worried about, you know, oh, I got to shoot a three, where's my foot at, is my foot behind the line, I kind of just shot the ball. So if I was behind the three-point line, I was behind the three-point line. If I was in front of it, I was in front of it. I didn't really care about, you know, where my feet need to be. I think that was the biggest thing going into my second season here was I was worried about where my foot was. You know, am I behind the three-point line or am I in front of the three-point line? I was just worried about that instead of just shooting the ball.
It feels like, too, Jared, that you've got to be – if you're a power forward in today's league, you've either got to be an elite shot blocker or a three-point shooter. Is it? It seems like that's the way that today's power forwards have become.
Yeah. I think that's the way this NBA is going. You know, you either got to be – you got to be something special to be at the four spot. And I think if you're not special, they just use a oversized three and they put them at the four now. And, I mean, a lot of these guys that's playing the four can play the three. If you look at it, Draymond Green, Paul Millsap, guys like that, they can actually play the three if you put them at the three.
Your focus last offseason, you had talked about, was on your conditioning. You came into camp and said that there was still work that needed to be done before you were in the condition you wanted to be in. Do you think that work got done during the season, or was there still more for you to do?
No, I mean, it got done throughout the season, but at the same time, like, you know, I feel like there's another level that I have to find. And for me to find that, I'm gonna have to go above and beyond to find it. You know, I think this summer would be the perfect summer to go find that win that I need.
Is that level that you want to get to, is that in terms of, like, is it a type of weight you want to be at, a type of condition you want to be in? How would you define it?
The type of conditioning I want to be at. Something that's going to be able to make me be able to be out there longer, be out there faster, and just be able to challenge everything that comes my way.
Did you feel towards the end of the season a little winded? Was there something like towards the end of the year that made you think I've got to be in better shape?
No, I think this was the first year that I played almost a whole season. I played 81 games. I missed one game due to, you know, a muscle spasm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just playing 81 games out of the 82, I think that was the eye opener, just because of the type of shape you have, not shape, but like the type of maintenance you have to take care on your body just to be successful in the NBA season is much needed.
John Lucas, who you worked with last summer, you came into camp and you said that John Lucas, one of the things he said to you was not to make a mistake. Do you feel like during the season you followed those rules or those instructions?
Yeah, for sure. I did follow those instructions, you know, not to make a mistake. I talked to him every day, almost every day throughout the season. And he kept asking me, what's going on? I'm just telling him, like, you know, I'm doing what you told me to do. And, you know, pretty much he told me, come into training camp or come into season, don't say a word, just be a team's player. I think, you know, by the numbers of my season and the numbers of our team season, I think we did a pretty good job of that.
Jared, hang on for just a second. I got to tell my listeners about a brand new product called MeUndies. Whether you're wearing a suit or sweats, you spend almost 24 hours a day in your underwear. But instead of making a statement, like Superman's tights under his everyday clothes, your underwear is probably pretty boring. MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. No questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Remember, Superman. Shipping is free in the U.S. and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair. Get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/Mannix. That's MeUndies.com/Mannix for 20% off your first order. MeUndies.com/Mannix. All right, we're back here with Jared Sellinger, Celtics forward. Your exit meetings with Brad, with the coaching staff, what were they like? What did they talk to you about?
Just how, you know, out of the 3 years of Brad coaching me, this might have been the most efficient year he thinks. And, you know, it was all good things, all positive things. And, you know, just looking forward to July and see what happens.
What's your relationship like with Brad?
You know, it's good. It's good. You know, it's competitive. I think that's the biggest thing. We're competitive with one another. When we see things, we tell each other. And he's open to listen, just like I'm open to listen.
That's interesting. I've never heard someone describe a coaching relationship as competitive. What does that mean exactly?
I mean, there's times where we disagree with one another, you know, and there's times where we agree with one another. But I think our competitive nature on both of our sides, it's meant for us to win. It's just meant for us to win. That's just our mindset.
Is he the kind of coach you want to keep playing for, if possible?
Oh, for sure, for sure. He's up and coming. He's doing a hell of a job of managing of our team the last 3 years, and I would love to come back.
This is obviously an incredibly big offseason in Boston. The number of draft picks that the Celtics have, much amount of cap space that the team has. As you head off into this offseason, how do you feel about your future with this franchise in particular?
We'll see. I understand there's a lot of free agents out there. I understand, you know, there's a lot of draft picks they have. There might be a lot of movement, but regardless of whatever happens, you know, I have to thank the Celtics organization for what they have done. They gave me a chance when nobody else was going to give me a chance. And, you know, just for that, I feel like I owe them money. I would love to come back.
Did you at any point discuss a contract extension with them before the start of the season?
No. Not that I know of.
Did you want to discuss one? Was it their idea? Was it your idea?
I don't know. I think with the cap space that's about to happen, I don't think Boston wanted to take up some of that cap space for next year just because of all the space that they have. And so we'll see. We'll see. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, the cap space is going to be insane for a lot of teams out there when this summer hits. And frankly, it's a great time to become a free agent for a guy like yourself who's going to have a lot of teams that are going to be calling about him. How do you go into this offseason? Are you looking for the best fit? Are you looking for the biggest contract? What are you looking for?
Honestly, you know, with this being my first summer, I really don't know. I really don't know. So right now, I'm walking there like a blind bat in a room, and just trying to figure out who's who and what's what. I really can't really say what's going to happen, but I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to walk in there and just, you know, whatever happens, happens.
As you go into that fifth year, I mean, what's the next step for Jared Sullinger? What's your game hopefully going to look like in the next couple of years?
I really don't like putting limits on myself, honestly. And I don't really put expectations out or goals. Whatever happens, happens. And, you know, I'm just going to try to evolve from the Jared Sullinger that has been in Boston for the past 4 years and work and try to be the best player that I can be.
Well, Jared, I appreciate it, my friend. Good luck in Europe next year. I wish you the best. I hope you get a good contract in Euros and everything works out for you pretty well at the end.
I think I can manage that.
Thanks, Jared. I appreciate it, man.
All right, boss.
Take care.
You're listening to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
A great business, you know, needs a stunning website. And with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery, grow your contact list, and get all the social media in one place, just the way you want it. Your customers are going to love it. So what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy, and most importantly, it's free. Welcome back, Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We got the NBA Draft Lottery Tuesday night here in New York City, and a guy that hopes to never be in the lottery again after this year, Tim Connelly, the general manager of the Denver Nuggets, kind enough to join me here in studio. What's up, Tim?
Nothing much. Thanks for having me.
So you clearly, you know, don't want to talk basketball. You want to talk wrestling, 80s baseball.
Yeah, 80s baseball and wrestling are two of my calling cards.
Two of them. What particular 80s baseball team is
your Orioles?
The Orioles.
Yeah, my brother and I used to work in Memorial Stadium.
Okay.
In Camden Yards. So say from 82 to the Why Not team is really my favorite.
Do you have like a baseball card collection somewhere of all this stuff?
I do. I have a Foot Locker, what I thought would be a retirement fund, and then they mass produce baseball cards.
Dude, I'm right there with you. I've got that Foot Locker as well.
Yeah,
back in Boston.
Like 26 Ricky Henderson rookies.
Yes. Yeah. Like what? They're worthless now.
A lot of Donruss, Fleer. What was the baseball
card? Tops.
Tops is the obvious one. What was the baseball card that reflected?
Oh, that was Fleer.
No,
wasn't it?
No. It was, I don't know.
I've got a whole chest full of baseball cards, all nicely mint condition,
yeah,
that are completely worthless.
My older brother's a big autograph guy, and he has, I would say, about 8 binders of every guy played from 1984 to 89. Mm-hmm. Again, they haven't seen the light of day in a long time.
These autograph guys nowadays, they're intense. Like,
Yeah, they're you see the same guys in every city.
Yeah.
I mean, they're committed. I give them credit for being, you know, regardless of the weather, they're always out there.
Yeah, they aren't even, they aren't kids either. Like, these are, no. Like, it's one thing to see the little kid with his, like, you know, Danilo Gallinari jersey he wants to hold out. And you've got, like, some dude with, like, Gallinari jersey, Gallinari poster, Gallinari.
Yeah, I think it's our contemporaries that just never grew out of it.
Yeah. I just, you know, I can't get into collecting anything anymore. After my baseball card sort of thing passed, it just doesn't work for me.
Nothing, anymore. Huh?
No, I can't collect it.
Nothing. You're not going to tell everyone on air what you collect?
I would love to tell you if I collected something. Did I don't?
It's going down a weird place right now.
Really, I think you started it, actually, putting it down that weird place.
I was just testing, seeing if you could.
No collections of any. No, I don't think I have any collections of any weird stuff right now. Sorry, so 80s baseball, pro wrestling?
Yeah, huge pro wrestling fan. Back in the day, yeah. We used to go to Errol's. Remember Errol's?
Errol's, no.
Errol's was a, they used to rent the VCRs. I don't know VCRs, the VHS.
Yeah, VCRs.
So yeah. We didn't have cable. We used to rent all the WrestleManias.
Yeah.
And that was great.
And watch them back. How long after? Like, you know, months?
Well, there's no internet. It wasn't covered in the Baltimore Sun. So to us, but the first time we watched it, we were shocked, you know. See Leaping Lenny Poffo beat Nikolai Volkov or something.
God, that is, what's that, 80s?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't get into it until like the 1990s. I think Ultimate Warrior was my introduction to WrestleMania.
Ultimate Warrior, yeah. I think, you know, Nikolai Volkov, actually, his daughter went to school with my sister.
Yeah.
And then my buddy, I think they still work together, Baltimore County Government.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys, wrestlers are real athletes. People mock wrestling for its, you know, scripted stuff. But man, those guys take a beating. It's not just the Monday Night Raws either. They're like on the road like 300 days a year.
No, really, I'm not into it anymore, but it is fascinating to talk about a tough life.
Yeah.
Some of the documentaries on the wrestlers back in the day are unbelievable. I saw one recently, Razor Ramon. Ramon and Jake Snake Roberts, who was it, Diamond Dallas Page, kind of got him back on track. It was really good.
Yeah, these guys were broken.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Later on in life.
Did you see the one on the Iron Sheik?
No, but I've actually encountered him at it was at a boxing match once, like 2 years ago. He was there for something. But I heard about that one where he's kind of, was he broke now or?
No, he's doing well. Just his Twitter is taken off.
His Twitter, yeah, I follow him. I'm an Iron Sheik. On your secret GM account, I'm sure you follow.
I don't have any secret account. I'm the most Twitterless guy in the world. And when we're
is
out,
that really true?
On my life, I'm on my phone enough. I have, like, for your Twitter, I have to Google Chris Mannix Twitter and see it, but. I figure
no like alert for me, you know, like just tweeted something.
No, zero Twitter, zero
Woj
Instagram.
There would be, you know, maybe.
No, zero. Yeah. So when I'm at sometimes these dinners with like my brother's a big Twitter guy.
Yeah,
the one in Phoenix, and he'll be reading. He's like, who are you texting with? And it's just Twitter. I feel so out of the times.
Yeah, I mean that. I find that a lot of NBA people have creeper accounts. They have those. The egg. They've got the egg on the front, and it's like your name is like JDX1473.
Yeah.
But you can't find them, but they can find you.
Yeah. Well, I think it's. I mean, I get it's worth. I mean, he's always reading some really cool articles. Send him along. I just I'm already addicted to my phone enough. I'd be scared to have one more kind of.
Yeah.
Addiction on there.
Yeah. Your brother, you mentioned, in Phoenix. Did you guys grow up, like, thinking, boy, we'd both like to be basketball executives someday?
No, dumb luck. We just went to graduating college was our ultimate goal.
Yeah.
One of seven. My older brother was kind of the one who set the table. He started playing at a high school that was really well known for basketball, small co-ed Catholic school that's since shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of followed suit. And then it just became a passion. Really, there's no great story. No, we weren't very good players. I wrote a letter. My mom got me a book, How to Get a Job in Sports, a little paperback book. I wrote the Knicks, Nets, Sixers, and Bullets at the time, and somebody wrote me back from the Bullets. And then somehow I'm here. I don't know how, and I don't know why, but I'm living proof. If I can do it, anybody can.
So you wrote a letter, because you started Washington, right?
Yep, I was at Fordham, transferring to Catholic with hopes of playing.
Right.
One of my best friends was playing down there. No big loss for that program. Yeah. You know, a turnover-prone, non-shooting 6'1 point guard.
Yeah, they there's not a big market for them.
No, not at all, not at all. I got the internship, and I switched my schedule around. To Tuesday, Thursday classes. Actually, I remember like yesterday, my first class at Catholic, I was a political science major at Fordham.
Yeah.
A great school. That wasn't one of their stronger majors at the time. It was not the case at Catholic. I think it was I'll mess up the class, but the first class I walked, I think like nuclear proliferation or something. And I said, oh, Tuesday.
Sounds interesting.
Once a week, Tuesday night, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah.
I walked in and the room was set up in a semi-oval, and I think my teacher also taught at the Pentagon. and I was in way, way over my head. So thankfully, basketball's worked out because my world politics are even Catholic.
So you wanted to be in politics then first? Is that
no, I wanted to go to – I liked history. I liked politics. I thought law school was probably my future.
Yeah. But you've got kind of that candidate thing going for you a little bit. I could see you running for, like, city council, state assemblyman.
Yeah, that's after 20 years on the road. I couldn't speak a word, you know, when I was a Catholic.
So you sent a letter to the Washington Bullets at the time.
Yep.
And they responded with what?
You know what? It was the summer when they had the Juwan Howard
mix-up.
So I think my sign-off was trying to be clever, like, the best thing is I won't count against the cap, you know?
Yeah. That's terrible.
It was great at the time.
Oh,
now, this is pre-internet.
I won't count against the cap. Who'd you send it? Who else?
Chuck Douglas. Chuck Douglas was assistant GM. Wes Unseld was the GM.
Right.
I owe so much to Chuck and Wes. Chuck, I went in to interview. I remember my first duty, the Bullets. I think the Bullets or the Wizards. The first year, now it's all blurry. They were playing a preseason game in Baltimore, and they asked the video guy, H. Lynam. Jim Lynam Jr. is one of my best friends, another guy that was unbelievably influential. He said, can you bring up backup tape? So we didn't have cable, so I think my aunt had to tape it, and the tape was like half, like 60 minutes, and it was embarrassing. I literally thought that night my career was over, and I get back down there sweating. I'm like, so sorry. He's like, dude, no big deal. We have six other copies. This is just an extra. Back in the day, you used to have to FedEx the tape into the league, you hoop one and also give one to the referee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they hired you as what, right? Of
nothing.
Nothing.
Free labor. So I took the internship, switched my class schedule around. I lived in the dorms of Catholic for about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Had a roommate who was about 9 years my senior.
Yeah.
So that was an easy switch to get out of the dorm life. I'm still not sure why one of my best friends, he lived right across the hall from me.
Yeah.
After 4 days, I said, why aren't I living with you? He said, that's a great question. Then I started. I had a couple side jobs. I was a busboy, ESPN Zone.
Yeah.
Party supply company. Used to build sets, which is funny now because I can't even build. I can't build IKEA furniture.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of random jobs. Did that for several years. Then I started working the video room. I worked for the Mystics for a couple of years.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was a lot of bench experience. And then I was trying hard to get a college job.
Right.
And I couldn't. Getting a lot of rejection letters. I was at Wits End, and then Wes Unseld was nice enough to give me a job with benefits. And then from there, a couple years later, going through the same thing, like, all right, it's not really fun living at home, commuting from Baltimore to D.C. every day. And then Wes and Michael Jordan once again kind of stepped up and been around some really cool people and been fortunate enough to form some good relationships. And again, I'm not sure how I'm in the seat in Denver. But
It's all about the timing of stuff, isn't it, too? I used to talk to Frank Vogel about this, because if I remember Vogel when he was an assistant, one of those regional advanced scouts, just bouncing around, he used to tell me, like, he was within a day or a couple of days of taking an assistant job on Rick Pitino's staff before Jim O'Brien called and said, I got this job in Philly. Do you want to come be on my staff? It's all just a weird confluence of events that these things tend to work out at.
It's so much serendipity. Frank... the year he was out, Wes Jr., who's now on staff in Denver, I think he hired Frank and Steve Silas to do advanced games for us.
Mm-hmm.
Two overly qualified guys just were on the wrong side of it for a year.
Yeah. Steve Silas is great. One of my favorite assistants.
He's great. Yeah. Vogel's a fantastic coach. Steve's going to be a great head coach. It's so much dumb luck. I think, you go to speak of these things now, and the people looking for these, these easy stop-to-stop stories. So I was dying to get a graduate assistant job.
Yeah.
Dying. I was trying hard. When I was overseas for 2 weeks, over the two-week period when I was in D.C., Wes Unseld Sr. retired. And the day I landed, Michael left the Wizards. So I left with two bosses ready. I was going to volunteer to live in Barcelona for a couple of years. I didn't have much of a presence in Europe. And the equipment guy picks me up from the airport. And, I have no cell phone over there. I'm clueless. He tells me what happened with MJ. I thought he was joking. So it's... this thing is all dumb luck. I say about 8 or 9% is hard work. I think most importantly, you have to have some sense of self-deprecation and don't take yourself too seriously, because so much of it's out of your control.
Yeah, and this is on a sort of a parallel way there with my own job there. It's like you start off in such poverty, and I remember living in Brooklyn on an air mattress for almost a calendar year. Like basically me, the air mattress, and a laptop watching Family Guy DVDs. That was all my entire life. I would go out, I would drink, I would work, and that would be the end of it. I mean, that's...
You do the same now, it just doesn't end in Brooklyn,
yeah,
it's Manhattan.
Now I go to my Manhattan apartment and say, oh, you're one to talk. Okay, all right, there, you know, lived in your... But, you know, I mean, you look back, though, in those days, and those were some fun days. I mean, it was a grind, and you didn't know where it was going. But that was, you know, living in Hell's Kitchen for a long time was one of my highlights for 6 years.
No question. The most, I mean, every day is more fun, and I'm so fortunate now. I love the guy I work for, the guys I work with. Mo's the best. Our front office, our tourism, those guys are amazing. So I'm having the time of my life now. But it was so much fun when your only responsibility was to watch players.
Yeah.
One of my biggest regrets about becoming a GM, one of the only ones, is I used to love going under 17, under 18, under 20s in Europe. It's a great chance to get a first look at those guys. You feel like you really see them progress, and you have a great feel for them. But also, it's just 4 games a day. You're walking the gym. You're having great dinners. You're going out afterwards. You're really off the grid, but seeing these next generation of European players and with more responsibility, you're not allowed to do those things. But it's it was so much fun. I wouldn't trade any of the experiences for anything, and it's insane where it ended.
When you're looking at an under 17 guy, like one of those young guys that's out there, when you're looking at one of them, how do you interpret what you're seeing? I mean, what is a 16-year-old? I mean, it's so hard to define a kid at that age. What are you looking at?
I think you look for some of the basics: athleticism, size, certainly basketball IQ. At that age, though, if someone says they have it figured out, I think that they're being disingenuous. So much is dependent on where they're going to play the following season. I think I've seen a lot of really good young European players whose careers didn't kind of reach where they should have been because their club team didn't allow them to develop and play through mistakes. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of luck with like Nikola Jokic last year. He was able to play under a very good coach in Mega in Belgrade. His coach, Dejan, very good coach. But most importantly, he was able to play through mistakes. Now, if he was at some of these bigger clubs, you're not allowed to play through the mistakes. And I think that's a really difficult decision to make. Financially, it makes all the sense in the world to go to these different top-notch European teams. But if you're in your formative years, you're not seeing the court. Remember Alexei Shved?
Yeah.
Shved was...
Russian.
He was dynamic at CSKA. He never was able to get on the court, but in practices. And, you know, he's had a very nice career. Played in the NBA, high-level European player, and a good guy. But I always wonder what it would have been like if he would have been able to play through some more mistakes and gain more confidence. Maybe he was at a level a bit too high, too young of an age.
Is it more difficult now just because it seems to me that when European teams have a guy that they know is going to go to the NBA, oftentimes they don't commit resources to him, whether it's playing time, practice time, whatever. So I think Hezonja was a good example of that last year, just didn't get the playing time he probably deserved playing for his European team. Is that a challenge you encounter or see out there?
Yeah, it's really scary because as much as you know, you don't know until you get the guy into your building, into your program. You're trusting a lot of people, and relationships become such a huge part of the equation. We're lucky to have our tourist, Karnashovas, on staff. I think his name resonates throughout every gym in Europe. I've spent so much time over there. International scout is excellent. But there is that fear. You know, you see examples of it all over the place of guys that would be impactful NBA players. They chose not to come over here, and it doesn't matter how good they are. If they're not in your uniform, they're not helping you.
Is there something about international players that you like more than, I mean, you wouldn't know what your peers like, but you look at your team, and they call the Spurs international team. You guys are very much international team, half dozen maybe international players on your roster. Something specific about how it falls?
It's funny, I get that question asked a lot. Yeah. We have a cheesy line in our office.
That's nice. We like cheesy lines on the podcast.
Here you go.
All right.
Is there a sound effects machine here?
We have one. No, we're too cheap here. We're in a basement right now, in case you haven't noticed.
We say from Kaunas to Kansas, it doesn't matter. We shouldn't have any biases, pro or anti, any player. It just so happens that we've gotten lucky with some of the European guys. We did focus on some European guys that maybe are a year ahead of the curve. Maybe they haven't shown themselves fully. So we look at a guy like Nikola Jokic, the kid we drafted last year, Nikola Vrdišević. He'll spend another year overseas, but we think he has a chance. It has nothing to do with anything. It could have been anybody at those selections. We thought it was the best player at the best time. The one thing we do like about the European players, they at times tend to come over with less pretense, mm-hmm. very appreciative of everything. You know, a guy like Nicole is playing in a small gym, limited resources. So he's really taking full advantage of all the NBA has to offer.
Is college basketball, I mean, how is it different now than when you first started scouting it 10, 15 years ago?
We had this discussion the other day in Chicago, a bunch of us, a couple different teams. I think the biggest difference now is there's too much information. Where 15 years ago, I would, if I knew the guy on the staff at Maryland, I'd call him, I'd talk to one other person, I feel like I got a really good lay of the land. Mm-hmm. Now, with the connectivity at your fingertips, you end up talking to 10, 12 guys about the guy, and sometimes at the end of the process, you're back to where you started. Mm-hmm. You know, eight love him, four say he's a serial killer. So,
yeah.
And that information is not just available to us in front of us, it's available to everybody. So you have some really, really bright media members, really bright fans, which challenge you. Well, that's a good thing, but at times I think the biggest difference is just when is enough's enough? You know, can he play? Can he fit your system? Is he coachable? What is he like as a guy, as a teammate? And then end of story. So I think at times you can end up chasing your tail.
Can you trust what college coaches say to you? I mean, I've heard horror stories from people that say, well, he sold us a bill of goods. Because college coaches, I would imagine, they get a first-round pick. That goes on their resume, too. Like, look, come here. It's a recruiting tool.
We trust the guys we know. Mm-hmm. We have relationships with them. We won't cold call a guy if we don't know him. It happened to us in D.C., and the kid ended up being a good kid. But I know we didn't know the staff that well, and the things he was telling the people he knew really well were different than what he's telling us. Mm-hmm. So we're very leery, and we always tell our guys, it has to be an organic relationship that's formed over years. If someone cold called me and asked about a player, I'd be less than forthright. Now, if someone I knew for years and years, I'd tell them exactly what it is. So I think you have to be very cognizant of the source.
Like, how did it work out with Gary Harris, a guy who was a good kid, a rising young player? Mm-hmm. How did you approach the figuring out of him?
I mean, Gary was an easy one.
Yeah.
Michigan State staff thought the world of him. We have a guy, a director, pro personnel, Jared Jeffries, is an mm-hmm. Indiana guy. Gary's from Fishers, Indiana. We had some pretty good connections to the university. Played USA basketball, so he was an easy guy to do background. It all came back glowing. And then this is actually a really good story. Josh's father, Stan, was a big Gary Harris guy.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're approaching the pick, it's always neat. You know, it's a fun to work for the Cronkies, knowledgeable basketball family. He's one of the guys that he'd watch closely, and Josh was very aware of him. So all those things add up, and we were lucky that he was there at 19.
All right, hang on 1 second, Tim. I'm going to try to pay some of my bills here for a second. Tickets are not an issue for you, but for others, been frustrated trying to buy tickets online. Try SeatGeek. Most sites make it complicated, and they all try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. SeatGeek is the only place I ever go to look for tickets to a game or a concert. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone. I just used it the other day. Great app. Use it all the time. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place so you save time and never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately accept underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed map to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket brokers, they show you the full ticket price range from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees on the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get that $20 rebate, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter promo code Mannix. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app, enter promo code Mannix today. So you like that, huh? Now I've given you $20 for being on this podcast.
It sounds good.
Isn't it great for you?
Sounds good.
So you go from Washington to New Orleans.
Yep.
That was your next stop. How does that happen?
Actually, that's a good story. I was in the under-20s in Zadar, Croatia. Mirotic's coming out party. Dell's been a longtime friend. He called me. He was involved with a couple different jobs. I think he was down in New Orleans in a different spot. We talked about, you know, the pros and cons, and he said, you know, if I take this, I'm going to call the next day. It's one of those things you believe when you see it, like, okay.
Yeah.
Sure enough, he called, spoke to Ernie. Ernie was nice enough to give permission to speak to Dell, and I took the job while I was in, after Zadar, I went down the coast to Var with a couple of buddies I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
Over Beers. I took the job. It was a surreal couple of days.
And you were at that time, what was your role with Washington?
Director of player personnel.
Yeah. Pretty cool, must be, to get offered a job as an assistant general manager. We'll get to the general manager part, but even at that point, at that age, well, how old were you? 29, 30?
No, this was 2010, so I was 33.
Yeah. So,
no, it was amazing. It was, every turn in my career has been more shocking. I can't believe that that no one's figured me out yet.
It seems like how the NBA has evolved over the years. You know, guys that hustle, whether it's coaching, general managing, scouting, they seem to be ascending more. You know, Eric Spoelstra down in Miami from the video room, Frank Vogel from middle of nowhere. I mean, guys you know and are close with. They rise up because of the hustle. I'm not sure that was true 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think we're at kind of a weird fork in the road where Spo's a good buddy.
Yeah.
It still amazes me when I look down there and he's all the success he's had. He's a heck of a coach. Masai is one of my really, really good friends. Mm-hmm. I look around all these guys that we were on these god awful European trips together, you know, dying to have our voice heard. Now to look up and see a lot of these guys in prominent roles is really neat. I think it's great to see those guys rewarded. The corporatization of sports, I think we might be kind of on the infancy stages of that where, mm-hmm. Like I said, I don't have any clear path to how I got here. I think you work hard, you keep your nose down, treat people right, and hope for the best. And when you talk to a lot of the guys who want to get involved in it, I think they see me now and don't see me, you know, living in my parents' house and working the Mystics and, picking up chocolate chip Sundays at ESPN Zone.
Nice.
It was really great.
Take something with you to go?
We used to kill the leftover foods. It was the first ESPN Zone, though.
Oh, the one in D.C.? Yeah,
Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah, that was the verb. Now, are they gone now? I think they're out of
existence. Was there one left? Is the one in New York still open?
No, the one in New York's gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a sad day in my professional background.
You know, you can take that line off your resume. Nobody can call for a reference there.
Well, I always joke. I was waiting for my first ESPN interview to kind of reference that. It would be a great buildup.
Do you consider yourself an analytics guy? I mean, a lot of the younger people getting in this business become kind of analytics guys from jump.
I was super, super fortunate again, where I was probably, talk about that fork in the road, I was at the convergence of old school scouting, working for Wes Unseld and Michael Jordan. So I was the young guy on staff, so I had to become learning in those areas. It's hard for me to consider myself an analytics guy, given my the only class I failed in college was math at Fordham. So it was fascinating, and it was really fun to kind of get in on the ground floor and meet all these really neat people with interesting and creative ideas. While still being appreciative that it's just one piece of the bigger pie. So I think guys around my age, we talk about that quite often, how lucky we are that we saw both and learned both, but I don't think we're too far on either side of the aisle.
Do you have to sort of be in between there? It's so polarizing an issue. You either like love analytics or you hate analytics. It seems like there's always people on both sides of it, and so very few, at least publicly, talk about being in the middle.
Yeah, we don't want to. Our first meeting as a staff in New Orleans. In Denver. I said, I don't want to have like our guys. Mm-hmm. I can't stand that term. That's my guy. Was it your guy? This guy's available. I don't want to be territorial in how we view things. And that goes to there's some people that really don't like European players. Some people that are anti-college players right now because of the lack of fundamentals or whatever misconception is out there. And we don't ever want to be that staff. We have a fantastic stats guy, Tommy Balchettis, Lithuanian guy, played at Harvard. This is a great story, shows you how smart I am. So I'm coaching in basketball at Borders in Moscow. So it's me, Melvin Hunt, Mario L.A., David Adelman. So you can imagine my camp record was pretty poor against those guys. So I meet Tommy. Tommy's working with NBA International, trying to expand their global footprint. I get the job and say, I need a smart guy in the office. So Tommy was very passionate about basketball. Worked as an analyst after college, and he was probably 6-8 months into the job in London. So he says, sight unseen, I'll take the job. You know, very low pay, tireless hours. Said, I'm passionate, I'll take the job. So he calls me a couple days later about logistics. Said, what do you want your title to be? I said, I assume analytics. That's why you called me, right? I said, I just called you because you're a smart, passionate guy, but if you can check that box also, this is fantastic. This is great. Great way to kill two birds with one stone. But Tommy's great because he has a sense of he played. Mm-hmm. He doesn't think it's the be all and end all. Arturis comes from Houston, which those guys do an unbelievable job of their analytics. They're kind of always at the front of the trends. So it's a neat tool we use all the time, but we don't ever want to be blindly allegiant to any one thing, whether it's just raw scouting, whether it's analytics. I think all those things should play into a bigger overall picture.
You worked with Jordan for what, a couple of years?
Yep.
What was any interactions, significant interactions with him?
Yeah, he was great. He was fantastic. Michael could not have been more
was
open.
He playing at that time? At
he was
end?
a little of both.
A little of both, yep.
Yeah, the last year he played, yeah. And then he was going to go back to the president's role. It was really neat. He was Michael is a guy that was very open to opinion as long as you put the work in. So I learned a ton from him. I remember the first day he came in, we had a meeting, and the first time to hear Michael curse, I'm like, yeah, I've never heard. I'm thinking,
that's so cool.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this isn't Jumpman or anything. I learned a ton from him and Wes both, and both those guys. Really allowed me to grow, and I certainly wouldn't be here without those guys.
What'd you think about what happened to him there? It's a different organization now, obviously, but I mean that went sideways in a weird way.
Yeah, I was following Darko Milicic during that time, so I was well below the fray. But I was shocked. I don't know what conversations happened, but from my experience with Michael, he's the best. He continues to be the super nice guy whenever I see him, and I learned so much from him. And to be around two legends like Wes Unseld and Michael Jordan every day was amazing.
Were you on Team Darko at that time?
I was not. It's easy to say now.
Yeah.
But it's he was a good player. I probably wasn't as high on him as some. But it's, you know, retrospect, it's always easy to be perfect. But he showed flashes. He had some really good years. The Orlando year when the shot blocking kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But there was I was following him for quite a bit, and it's, you know, he might have, again, talked about wrong place, wrong time. If he goes to a different team, maybe his career is differently. It's never easy. Certainly a super talented guy, just can never figure it out.
Was he a workout warrior? Because the sense was in Detroit back then was that he had some incredible workouts for them, and that's why they drafted him.
You know, he was a talented guy. He still is a talented guy. He's not too old.
Yeah. Kickboxer now, I believe.
Kickboxer, yeah. Some pretty intense videos.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting course correction.
Yeah, actually, randomly, Nikola's, Jokic's two older brothers are very good friends. They kind of grew up with Darko. I think he's a guy that, my guess from afar, I don't know him, is question how much he loved the game, I think. So talented. And look, he was put in a tough spot. With the other guys in his draft class were able to sink and swim off the bat and make mistakes and play through it. He went to a championship caliber team. He had a nice NBA career.
One would think that'd be a good thing, though. No, I mean,
yeah, I mean, look, it's easy. I'm sorry, it's not easy to say which way's better. I don't know. The guys drafted around him were from jump handed the ball, and that certainly can be helpful. But he was playing from behind some great vets. Chauncey's a great vet, good guy. Rip Hamilton. Really good guy we had in D.C. I don't know. It'd be unfair for me to even comment. I don't know Darko well enough. He had a nice NBA career. It's just kind of he was probably picked around a bunch of guys going to be Hall of Famers. So
you're in New Orleans, you know, clearly dominating the assistant general manager scene at that point. You get a call from Denver. How does that happen for you?
Yeah, that was really weird as well. We're at lunch with
you seem to have a lot of weird how things happen weirdly for you.
Yeah, it's weird and luck are using words I use quite often. We're at lunch with Dell's son, Riley, who's finished a heck of a year at Newman High School. Mm-hmm. He can really shoot the ball.
Scouting.
Yeah, Riley had a great year. Trey Burke, Alex Lynn, I think Michael Carter Williams, and I'm blanking on the fourth. We're at Emeralds. I get a call. Dell gets a call. He's gone for a long time. I make some off-color joke about, is your dad not feeling well, in front of the guys, trying to lighten the mood a bit. I think it's the Friday before the draft. Dell comes back and says, Josh Kroenke wants to talk to you. I said, you know, why?
What'd I do?
Yeah, so a night of cramming about where they are in terms of some of their assets, some of their salary cap situation moving forward. I land in Denver. I knew Josh a little bit through Masai. Had a great conversation, and 2 hours later, and I'm over dinner, I'm taking the job.
How do you I mean, you said you cram on that team. Is it just like look at their cap space, look at their pick situation, come up with their – oh, you probably have a philosophy of your own at that point of how to build a team, yeah. I'm assuming.
Well, that one was, again, lucky. Mm-hmm. I knew Denver inside and out for a couple of different reasons. First and foremost, Masai. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it's a team we studied closely because we had a bunch of cap room. And they had one of their premier free agents that year in Iguodala. So the conversation was more kind of big picture. It never got overly specific. I had my suit ready on Sunday, you know. thankfully, Josh showed a ton of faith in me. It's been a challenging couple of years because I don't think we've won like certainly he had envisioned and that we had hoped. But I'm pretty fired up about where we are now, the eve of the lottery, with the young pieces, guys like in their entering their prime like Gallo and Wilson, Fareed, and a bunch of salary cap room and a bunch of picks.
You got the ship kind of right a little bit. Mike Malone's done a great job for you as the head coach there. Last year, what you were going through, you know, having to let go of Brian, the turmoil kind of within the team. I mean, did you have any self-doubts in that moment? Like, well, maybe this is a big challenge?
No, I get more Catholic guilt.
Yeah.
We didn't deal Brian the best hand. Mm-hmm. Brian's a good guy and a very good coach. And in a different situation, that would never materialize like it did. I tell you, I got advice, great advice a long time ago. Like, never be scared to make a mistake because you're hired to be fired anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't take this job that seriously. I say that with all due respect. I think we work as hard as anybody in the league. I'm at times obsessive about it. But I also know the naturally farcical nature of our job. It was more so I just felt guilty for the fans and felt guilty to Josh. He took a chance on me, and I had not repaid him in a way that I think he's deserving.
What's Mike done to kind of, in his own way, right the ship for you?
Mo's fantastic. And I was lucky that I knew Mo. We worked together in New Orleans. Prior to that, he went to school at Loyola of Baltimore. When he was at Manhattan in Providence, he recruited some of my older brother's kids. So there was a natural familiarity that allows you to hit the ground running. Never know what different decisions are made or how they're made with various organizations, but I thought he was doing a hell of a job with Sacramento. So he was a guy that's unbelievably prepared, a basketball lifer, cares, a very good person, and I think he's a guy that wasn't fully appreciated in his previous job. So all those attributes started to show up in how we played. I thought, our win-loss record is not where we want it to be, but I thought we were tough out every night. And certainly we're trending in a direction that leaves us all pretty optimistic.
What's his – I mean, is it – what was it about him that sold you? You said you knew him in the past. That relationship obviously carried a lot of weight with you. When you interviewed him, what was it that sold you on him?
You know, I was kind of sold on Mo throughout the process. It was more selling the rest of the organization. He had a brief stint in Sacramento. Some of the guys that every decision in Denver is a group decision. I don't believe in closing the door and coming out and making a decision independently. And I didn't want to be I don't want to be the loudest voice in the room all the time. So sit down with Josh or Torres or Jared and these guys. Said, what do you think? And after the first time we sat down with Mo, Torres was really impressed by his preparation, his attention to detail. Mo's also just a really good guy. Got a great sense of humor, fun to be around. The next step was getting in front of Josh, and Josh was similarly impressed, and then we moved pretty quickly from after that second meeting.
Now you're in the lottery. Obviously, you don't want to be in the lottery. You want to be in the playoff mix every single year, but you're in a great lottery position right now with a couple of picks, right, in this lottery mix?
Well, we're going to have the better of ours or New York. Mm-hmm. So it's slotted 7. We also have 15, 19, and a couple deep second-round picks. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a busy month for us.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of players you can take with those picks, but also you could package them if you wanted to. I mean, how do you approach, do you, at this point with all the young guys you have, are you looking to get older? Do you look to...
It's funny. One of the guys in our staff, he said, we have to go over a 3 to 5 year plan. I said, if you have a 3 to 5 year plan, you're way better than I am. The nature of this business is so fluid. Now we plan for every option. If we take this guy here, what's next? If we think we have a real target in free agency that it's realistic we can obtain, then how does it influence our thinking on draft night? I think all those things are very much hypothetical. Tomorrow's the first day it becomes real. So I think we have countless scenarios. But for all those scenarios that you prepare for, you get one call and it's all out the window. So we don't know which direction we're going. There's certainly 19 guys we like. We're not we wouldn't be hesitant to take three first round guys if it's guys we think can help us. We tend to be aggressive. We like to be opportunistic when something presents itself. But you know, as tomorrow night's the first chance, we'll have a crystal clear picture of our full off season. Then we'll move forward from there.
People only, the public at large, only generally gets what reporters kind of give them, like the gossip, if you will. When how much of the gossip that's out there is true, and how much doesn't get out there?
Yeah, we tend to be pretty tight-lipped. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys have a job to do, certainly, and but it's for us internally, we always question the logic of kind of doing your bidding publicly. I like to think
a lot of times, though, it doesn't come from it can come from an agent.
Sure, sure.
It can come
no.
from a friend of a guy. It doesn't necessarily have to come from an organization.
Only so much you can control.
Right.
Right. And there's no secrets in our profession. But
not among agents.
No. We think less is more. So, we, look, I'm after a couple of newspapers, Hoop Sites, my third or fourth website I check out. I read the stuff at times as gospel, depending on you can kind of read through the lines, who the source is, what the team is. Is this something that's potentially actionable, or is it something that's just someone throwing some something against the wall? But, you know, you have to have an ear to the ground, and that's not just the media, but always having these various relationships you have to make sure you're always talking to guys so you never miss an opportunity.
It's weird because something can be true and not real simultaneously. Like, I'm sure you get 100 phone calls a month on a certain guy, and if it gets out, technically it's true, but even if you didn't consider it, you know, it's there.
There was a thing a couple of years ago where a deal that was completely not true, 100% not true, and I flew back from a game, a guy called me, my phone was blown up with these texts and emails. And a guy called me. I respected. Does this happen? I said, honestly, I'm not, you know, blowing smoke. There's, I don't even know where this came from. Go to grab a sandwich, and he hits me back. Now it says the first round of all. This guy's tweeting about it. I said, I don't know what to tell you. I'm getting a turkey sandwich right now in Denver. Oh, yeah, my wife's getting Italian sandwiches. I mean, zero. What's really difficult and at times really frustrating is when you have to almost acknowledge false stories, because it's like when you go into a store. I like it when you go into a store and someone follows you around, you're not stealing, but you still feel guilty. That's how you feel at times with these non-stories. So I think the best way to get deals done is to be quiet as much as you can. But you're right, there's no secrets.
You did something smart in the last couple of years where you were signing guys. You signed guys a little early to these extensions where you paid them some good money, but that money looks pretty sharp nowadays when this summer expects to be just as crazy as you can possibly expect.
Well, it was twofold. It doesn't happen without Danilo and Wilson loving Denver.
Yeah.
Those guys, I think, both knew that where the market was going. Both guys have excellent agents. But both guys have been very outspoken about how much they like the city. And then our salary cap guy, Ben Tenzer, was a step ahead of the curve. Look, this is where it's going. With the new TV revenues, the reality is going to be very different next year. We saw that quickly. Free agency last year was some of the deals we saw. So those are the guys that deserve all the credit. And then Josh having the foresight as well to kind of be a bit ahead of the curve. But it's as happy as we are to have those guys off the free agent market this year. What makes us even happier is that those guys kind of sought it out, and they did so because they liked the city and the organization.
Probably $90 million in that range for the cap in this summer. I've heard as high as 110 in the next summer. I mean, is it going to be as wild as people like me and others expect it to be?
Again, it's we're guessing. My guess is yes, yeah. But we also internally say how much is self-fulfilling? You know, how much are we talking into being wild?
Yeah.
You know, how reactionary will the market be? I think we're in uncharted territories, and the new financial realities are going to hit us all in the face pretty good. How do you tell ownership that I know this number sounds extreme, but this is tantamount to what we paid this guy 3 years ago. And also, how do you kind of save your gunpowder? I think the last thing you want to do is spend just to spend.
Do you have any good luck, you know, techniques, good luck stuff go for tomorrow, or Tuesday, or should I say?
I got nothing. I mean, Denver's one of the few teams that's never moved up. So I think, you know, the odds are in our favor. I like where we are at 7. I'd like where we are at 1, 2, 3 even more. But we're not scared to take a pick at 7, or if we drop a pick. I think we'll be fine regardless. But it would be fun if a little luck kind of finally came away on lottery night.
Are you able to evaluate? I mean, you read all the time. People say, oh, it's a draft that's deep from 15 to 45. It's a two, you know, we know the top two players. Ben Simmons and Brandon Ingram are the two top two guys in the draft. But how do you look at this draft compared to others? Or can you at this point?
I think last year was special. And we felt that during the evaluation process. And there was guys that we really liked up to 14. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty aggressive in targeting a couple of those guys. Now, some of those guys have hit it out of the park in the first year, way more so than we thought initially. I think this year will be a bit more challenging because the separation isn't as intense. But again, when people say that it's a bad draft, every draft's good. You've got to find the right guy. Dickie McGuire used to say, I know who to pick, just not there when I'm picking.
Yeah.
You know, you got to do your homework. You got to cross your fingers. Know it's a mistake. It's a mistake-laden decision. Don't be scared of it. Trust your process and hope for the best.
But you're right. There's always guys that are drafted in the middle part of the round, even once a year, at least in the second round. I mean, I remember Giannis Antetokounmpo, 15 at the time, has turned out to a terrific player. Rodney Hood, who I don't know why people are passing. I say this all the time. Like, Rodney Hood was great at Duke. I don't know really why everyone was walking away from him at when they were. They're always there. It's all upon the person making the decision. Find the talent.
Well, I liked it too. Portsmouth Invitational. It's one of my favorite events. I was going there even high school and college, and you know the half full guys. This is a great event. You're going to find some players. Then you have the curmudgeons like this thing stinks. There's no players. There's always players. I think at times it's an easy way out to say there's no players because it kind of it can be cowardly. You know, it's easier to say what a guy can't do. It's easier to say there's no players because you're taking the field in a mistake guessing game. That's all it is. So we're pretty optimistic. We like a lot of players in this draft. Chicago last week was another chance to evaluate to know guys. So we feel good about if we're 7 or we're 8 or 1, 2, 3. Certainly 15 and 19 are in stone. We feel good about all the spots.
Are you one of the trick question guys in Chicago? Do you hit them with the how many basketballs can fill the room or how many pennies in the jar?
We are. I don't know if you talked to any of the players. I would imagine that we leave a pretty good impression. We're very casual. We talk about our team. We ask some questions about us, and we'll do some fake trick questions at times. Mm-hmm. We'll say, there's four snacks on the table, and it'll be gummy bears and Pop-Tarts and M&M's and make it up, Twizzlers. Mm-hmm. Which one would you pick? And the guy, and we'll have one of the guys fake take notes. Like, all right, so that tells a lot about you. We have fun with the process. I couldn't imagine. I'm a 19-year-old kid.
You're screwing with that kid's head. Right
well,
there.
I tell him.
Afterwards.
We have two guys who are almost identical height on staff. Yeah. So when it really gets lull and the guy we're interviewing, you can tell he's kind of worn down. We'll say, who's taller? Guess. And these guys are identical. It's a good parlor trick. But I couldn't imagine. I'm 18, 19 years old. They know everything about what I did at Fordham. They have a room full of adults, and they're just grilling you. I couldn't imagine how difficult that would be.
Can you get – I mean, what are you looking for in general in those conversations? Because these guys have been prepped. Like,
sure.
They have agents. They've all been prepped. Agents tell them what they're likely to be asked. I mean, you want to get, I'm assuming, the most natural, real answers you can possibly get. How often do you get them?
I think one of the things that our staff does a tremendous job with is our relationships allow us, I think, to get maybe a bit more real information than most. Whether it's Jared, his 11-year NBA playing career, Jim Klibanoff, director of scouting, Scott Howard has worked, 20 years in college. Herb Livesey is an 80-year-old, just a wealth of information. Knows all these guys and helps me having younger brothers. A lot of these guys, there's been some interaction. So we like to ask the questions that kind of catch them off guard. At the end of most interviews, we kind of challenge them to ask us questions, but with a caveat, no questions your agents told you ask. I don't want to hear the questions, how can I become the best player? Or how do you envision me helping build a championship team? We're a team that prides itself on hard work, but certainly we want to have fun doing it. And that fun equates to a casual atmosphere. So I think the more you kind of get the kids off kilter, the more they get regular, and then I think you can glean some things from those discussions.
Is there a natural instinct to draft younger players, or is there, I guess, a bias against some older players nowadays? I mean, back in when you started and even before that, guy goes 3 or 4 years, that's just what happened. Now, guy comes out for his freshman year, it just seems like if it's a toss-up amongst a lot of people around the league, they're taking the younger guy over the older guy because of the upside potentially of the younger guy.
Well, that might be where analytics comes into play, too. Yeah. Just the harsh reality for these 4-year guys, and it's not fair. And a lot there are outliers. I mean, Damian Lillard was a 4-year guy. How good is he? You know, yep. Jimmy Butler. I mean, Dame came out after junior year, but had the red shirt, so he was 4 years of college.
I feel like everyone should take a mid-major guard. Whoever the mid-major yeah. guard is right now, it's like the last 5 years. You know, whether it's Elfrid Payton, Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, draft
them. It's worked.
Steph Curry.
It's really worked. But you know, that's where analytics comes in. You say, hey, tell this guy has these characteristics. Tell me what his best case scenario is. And age is a big weight in a lot of those different studies and those scales. But again, I don't think there's any steadfast rules in this profession. So I think every guy's reviewed independently and individually. And if you think a 4-year guy is the best player, you got to go with it.
Do you remember your scouting report on Steph Curry, if you had one?
Yeah, we were very high on Steph Curry in D.C. He had a heck of a workout in D.C. I actually remember like yesterday, I think it was him, Johnny Flynn, two other guards. I think maybe Boubois, was he that draft?
Roddy Boubois was, yeah, he was 20th or something.
Well,
like
Flip
that,
Saunders had a drill where you chased, who was the fourth guard? You chased the ball handler. Mm-hmm. Four guys trapping, and he had the ball on a string. It was the most impressive I had ever seen a guy just handling the ball. I didn't say two-time MVP.
I was going to say, that's when you told Flip, like, two-time MVP. That's
yeah, I was all over it. Everyone really saw him being the two-time MVP, but you never know.
Lock. Total lock.
Think about Steph's first couple of years. I mean, when did he see the playoffs?
Yeah.
He didn't see it right off the bat. I think what Golden State did, which they deserve so many kudos for various things, but they had patience. And they allowed that team to grow. And if you have patience, if you have a guy like Steph who works his tail off and is so naturally talented, and you see how Klay developed, you see how Draymond developed, the Boga trade was huge. But, again, it's so easy to be impatient. If you have the right guys and the right coach, which they certainly have, and a fantastic front office and ownership group, they were patient. Now look at them.
Yeah, and everyone thinks you've got to have – you know, 1 and 2 in the draft. That's the only way to win. It's a public perception. I don't know if everybody, obviously nobody in the league thinks that, but you look at the way the Warriors have developed. You know, they're the best team in NBA history statistically, and they've got guys who are drafted 6, 10, second round. I mean, this is what we were talking about earlier. The talent's there.
They did a fantastic job. Bob did a fantastic job. Ownership group, all those guys. You know, they did the hard way. The draft, when you walk away with Draymond Green and Zelly and Barnes. Again, show the ownership showing faith in Steph Curry with his ankle injury. Mm-hmm. That was an easy decision. It wasn't universally lauded when they made that decision.
There's a reason he's the fifth highest paid player on his team. I mean,
but again, I think if you trust the process and you kind of have an ounce of luck on your side, and you have the right people making the decisions, I think you can see success if you err on the side of patience. But in today's age, that's not always the case.
Tim, appreciate you stopping by, man. Good luck tomorrow night. You're due for good luck. You know, you've had no good luck in your life, so I figure, you know, after some of these stories, I figure you've had no good luck.
Yeah, I think I've sucked up all the luck. The fact that
the franchise has not had good
married kids. That's amazing. That's maybe the luckiest thing ever.
You really got to throw that in, don't you? A little family talk there.
Well, I have to. I mean, a lot of time on the road.
Your wife's
right
gonna be listening. make sure you throw that in there.
She's a big Mannix podcast girl.
I mean, I appeal to that demographic. Yes.
But the next time, I wish I just have a non-basketball. Anything but basketball.
We could have done that. I mean, I was just pivoting because it seemed like your Orioles stories had completely run out.
Oh, please. I had hours and hours of Rich Dower, Mike Devereaux, Cal Ripken, Mike Boddicker. Who else?
I remember my former Red Sox,
yeah.
Mike Boddicker.
Yeah, Mike Boddicker, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Bob Mulacky.
Mike Mussina was on those teams.
Mike Mussina left the Yankees. That was a bad day in New York.
Yeah,
Roberto Alomar, Mike Bordick.
Man, you go.
Lenny Sakata.
Now you're into the 90s, though.
Yeah, well, that was better teams. Yeah. You know, there was a long lull.
I don't really understand Baltimore, though, because it seems like every time they play the Red Sox, there's like 60% Red Sox fans in the stands.
Well, I think it's a socioeconomic thing. I think the wealthy
are in Boston.
Yeah, they all come down and take over the
guys
stadium.
Living in South here coming to.
It was funny. I went to the Ravens played in the Super Bowl. I live right down the street. It was fantastic. We were lucky enough through for the Saints, Mickey Lomas and those guys. We bought tickets. We had to buy tickets before the AFC Championship. So they beat the Patriots, right?
Yeah.
Just making sure.
Yeah.
So thank
God. Got that. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank God, because I committed 8 tickets fake, so we're pretty expensive, for the family to come down. So walking over to the Superdome, it was 75% Baltimore. You think you're in Fells Point. You're thinking Canton. We walk into the Superdome. Actually, a guy I was with, who I hadn't seen in years, he goes, "All right, man, I'll see you later." "So you're not going in?" "I don't have tickets. I just came down to party." You walk into this stadium, and there was 25% Baltimore fans. So I don't know. Maybe there's some parallel with Camden Yards.
All right. Well, next time, Orioles podcast and wrestling podcast only.
Perfect. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks for stopping by, Tim.
Thanks a ton.
That's it for today's episode. My thanks to my guests, Jared Sellinger of the Boston Celtics and Tim Connolly of the Denver Nuggets. Don't forget, you can download this podcast and all archive podcasts everywhere. You can download them, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, you name it, you can find it. You can also get the Vertical Podcast with Woj and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick while you're at it. See you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.